Good morning. And the next matter on for oral argument this morning is State of Minnesota versus Defoe. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel, if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. The timing restrictions are indicated in a light and clock in the lectern, which you can raise or lower to match your height for your convenience. We only ask that you state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so that we can keep track of it in the audio recording that we make available to the public. And counsel for appellant, you may proceed whenever you're ready, and I don't mean to rush you. Take your time. I know you're coming up to the table, so whenever you're ready, you have the floor.
Instructions to not touch the mic, is that we, or can I adjust the mic?
You certainly may adjust the mic. I don't know if we have those instructions. I don't think we,
At one time, it was don't touch the mic.
Yeah, at one time. Yeah, we had a lot of, stay 6 feet apart and other things that, on reflection,
well, no,
don't
like
seem
to. Well, that was like early days. Maybe everything's been fixed.
Yeah, I think hindsight gives us a little more illumination about how overly protective we might have been. You have the floor.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Suzanne Senecal Hill, and I'm an assistant state public defender representing appellant Joshua Defoe. There are two arguments before this court today. First, Mr. Defoe's first-degree test refusal conviction must be reversed because the circumstantial evidence supports a reasonable hypothesis that Mr. Defoe did not demonstrate an actual unwillingness to refuse to submit to chemical testing.
Would your argument be the same if we applied a direct evidence analysis?
I think I would have a tougher time with a direct evidence analysis, but I do think that this court's decision in Ferrier would still guide this court in terms of looking at the totality of the circumstances and the context within which that interaction took place. My
Can
second.
I just follow
oh,
up
sure.
On that? I don't mean to.
No, it's fine.
Attorneys to have a chance to at least outline what they want to say. Would you like another?
Unlike Judge Ross is what she's saying.
Well, no, I think this court knows the second issue is the Franks issue, which I also think would entitle or would require this court to reverse his test refusal conviction. But I do, in the limited amount of time we have, I did plan to spend and would like to spend our time talking about sufficiency, so that's fine.
Okay.
We can jump into it.
Well, I'd like you to address, if you would, right off the top, why is this not subject to a direct evidence standard?
Sure. I think there are a couple of points on that. First, what this court says in Ferrier is that to refuse is indicative and requires an intent to refuse, and intent is normally proven by circumstantial evidence.
But in Ferrier, just to distinguish it, there was never any statement made by the defendant.
Sure, but if you look at this court's body of law since Ferrier, applying Ferrier, and even this court applying Ferrier post-Schwartz, you will see that this court routinely applies a circumstantial evidence case, and even in, State v. Serre, this court applied circumstantial evidence, even though one of the interactions was, will you take a breath test, and the defendant said no. But this court applied circumstantial evidence because the context still matters, and even though it was a direct question answer, it still, in a vacuum, maybe informed the decision, but in the totality of the circumstances of that interaction, it wasn't clear what the intent was, and there were reasonable hypotheses both ways, and that's what we have here. I'm not saying that there's not a reasonable hypothesis that Mr. Defoe demonstrated an actual unwillingness to refuse to test, but I'm saying that there also is a reasonable hypothesis, given the context and the circumstances of that exchange, that he did not demonstrate an actual unwillingness to refuse to test. The other thing I'll point out is that his no was not in response to a direct question. And I'm hoping this court has had a chance to review that recording and see not only how short it was, but also that it wasn't an engaging conversation between the officers and Mr. Defoe. There were lulls and pauses, very distinct ones that if I sat here uncomfortably making them, you would notice those long pauses. But also, they're continually trying to rouse him up. This isn't a person who is alert and cogent, and there's no indication that he's really tracking what's going on. And if you look at it, what the last question to him was, so do you wish to take something, blood or urine? And then there's this long pause, and then it's, I think it's like, Josh. And then in a grovelly voice, he's like, no. But again, there's a reasonable hypothesis there that if you listen to it, he's not saying no, like, no, I'm not doing whatever this is that you said. It's get away from me. I've been in this cell for 3 hours. I'm frustrated. I've been sleeping. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. There really isn't an indication that he understands what's happening there and that he is actively choosing to refuse to test, which is what Ferrier requires. You know, there's one other piece that I want to point out in terms of what does his conduct show, and the state would like this court to believe
that. Just to clarify,
sure.
I don't think it was the officer says, Josh, and then he says no. I think it, if I understand the transcript correctly, it was Josh, what?
Yes.
He's asking you a question. No.
What's the question? I mean, I've listened to that recording more times than I care to admit, actually, because I'm trying to make sense of it. I'm trying to put myself, actually, in Mr. Defoe's position of what would I have understood when I'm in a cell, lights out, I'm sleeping, according to Officer Zulke, I maybe slightly turned my head.
When you said, what's the question? You mean, that's your rhetorical.
Yeah, like,
that's
well, not what him. What is the question?
Well,
here?
The question. So do you wish to take something, blood or urine? He's asking you a question. No.
Yeah.
I mean, isn't the question, so do you wish to take something, blood or urine?
But what is that in the context of everything? I mean, sure, there is a reasonable interpretation here that he's saying, no, I'm not going to test. But you can't take these things
well,
in
what other question was presented to him?
Are you up? That was one of them. We got it two times, are you up? We got to ask you something. But, you know, he says this no.
Well, Josh, are you up? Yes. So he answers that question. After he answers that question, was there some other question asked before he was told he's asking you a question and he responded no? Was there any other question that might reasonably be presented in that dialogue?
Well, I think if you listen to what he says, again, we're nitpicking here a little bit, but I want to make sure that we're putting this in the real life context and not the artificial context of you know this proceeding. He doesn't say yes as if he's really alert and awake. He's more like again a grovelly like yeah. And again, you look at
well, whether he was grovelly or not, there was a yeah response to the question: Are you up, Josh? You up? Answer, yeah.
In his groggly
voice or whatever kind of voice. So do you wish to take something, blood or urine? He's asking you a question, and he says no. I mean, there are only two questions asked in the dialogue, and it seems to me you've got two answers. Are you up? Yes. Do you want to take something? No. I mean, in order to find that this is ambiguous, I mean, I get it. If he'd been asked a series of questions, like lawyers do when they're trying to trip up a witness, that doesn't seem to be what happened here. So it disabused me of what appears to be a linear question and answer dialogue.
I have to strongly disagree with you. I don't think that this is a linear conversation. Again, you have to put it back in the real life context and not what's on this page. If you listen to it, there is some questions and answers, but it is not an engaging conversation. They are.
So if we listen to it, and I admit that I haven't listened to it, and
please do, Your Honor.
Will I hear other questions besides, do you want to take something, blood or urine, before he answers no?
You won't hear other questions, but you will hear the context of those questions. You will hear the pauses. You will hear those officers continually trying to rouse him up and get his attention. You will hear his groggy voice.
Will I hear any words other than what's on the transcript?
I carefully noted the words. Those are the words. My interpretation of those words is that you can look at it two different ways. And there is a reasonable hypothesis here that given the context, again, we're
talking... What's the other reasonable hypothesis to his answer, no? What else would he be responding to?
I would ask this court to listen to the recording and to hear...
No, I understand that. Asking you,
sure.
If I listen to it, what other reasonable conclusion would I draw other than that he's answering the question that had just been presented to
him? Sure. There, given the tone and the context, there's a reasonable hypothesis that the no is just kind of what we all do when we're woken up in the middle of the night of like, get out of here. It just seems like a no, go away, more than a true intent to say, no, I'm refusing to test.
Okay.
And then you look at what happened after.
Can you talk about that reasonable hypothesis in the context of the entire discussion? Let's presume that the officer says, Josh, you up, Josh, you up, and he just says no there. That makes sense, but it seems he answers two questions, and I did listen to the video. I would agree with you. It's clear that he's groggy. It's clear that his voice may have not been, you know, like we're having the discussion here, but I guess the hurdle I'm having here is that there are two distinct questions, and he answers those questions distinctly different. Are you up? Yes.
Yeah.
And then to the second question, and do you wish to take something? Josh, what? He's answering your question. No. So again, two separate questions, two separate answers, and those answers actually address the question before him, that being, are you up? Yes. Do you want to take something? No. I'm trying to understand, even in the context of being in a dark cell, just being woken up, what is another reasonable hypothesis? And I guess it's the question that him being woken up is the reasonable hypothesis.
The way Your Honor laid that out is a very linear exchange. I think what's important is to also remember what the tone is, remember what the pauses were. Those are distinct pauses.
But, counsel, I understand that, and taking into account those pauses, taking into account the tone of his voice, taking into the account the fact he was in a dark cell, it seems to me the discussion is linear, and he is answering the linear questions presented before him. So how can this court, or can you walk me down the path to get me beyond what you're saying, not looking at this linearly when it is a linear discussion with linear questions and linear answers?
I stand by my argument and vehemently stand by it that there is a difference between you and I doing this and me looking you in the eyes and me understanding what you're asking and you understanding what I'm saying versus what happened in that cell. I do agree with you that, yes, you could read it that way. I just disagree with you that that's the only way that you can read it.
And I guess the question is, what is the other way? Because, again, we need to find that there is an alternative. And I get the argument that we may not look at it linearly, but again, what is the reasonable alternative to the way in which we're reading it right now?
It is the opposite. I mean, what you're suggesting and what you're saying is that there is, this evidences an actual unwillingness to refuse to test, which is what you require. I'm saying that you can listen to this audio and you can also say there is a reasonable hypothesis that he did not demonstrate an actual unwillingness to refuse to submit to testing. That's what I'm saying.
Can you just fill in the second part? There's not a hypothesis that he refused because...
Because the recording simply doesn't demonstrate that this groggy no... at the end of 30 seconds, indicates that there's an actual unwillingness there. And there's no follow-up. It just, it seems like...
In order for you to prevail under a circumstantial evidence, let's assume we got to, this is not direct evidence, mm-hmm. this is circumstantial evidence, then we would have to conclude that a reasonable fact finder could interpret this not as a refusal.
Absolutely.
And you're, if I understand you correctly, that's sort of based on just he's groggy, he's...
Yeah, there isn't a bright line rule. There isn't a rule that says, you know, there's no magic formula here, much like if officers say, oh, I saw furtive movements, or oh, based on my training and experience, or oh, he was nervous. I mean, you don't just take those in a vacuum. I'm asking you not to take this no in a vacuum. I'm asking you to consider it in the real life context with which it happened. And yes, I do think that if you listen to this in the context by which it happened, then there is a reasonable hypothesis that this was not an intent. This was not an actual unwillingness to refuse to test.
I have a question. You're running low on time. And
sure.
Obviously, you've got many issues, but we do have the benefit of your brief, Ms. Senecal-Hill. But with respect to this, this was a jury trial, correct?
Correct.
Okay. How was this evidence presented? Was this tape played for the jury, or was it read?
It was played.
It was played.
It was played.
And I know the defendant did not testify, so we have no testimony from him with respect to what he heard or thought or meant or any of that sort, right? The jury just heard this tape. And
right.
I will say, as Judge Harris, I have listened to it as well. So I just wanted to understand that that was what the jury heard. So we're looking at what's in the record and whether or not the jury had a sufficient basis to reach the conclusion it did.
Right, although I will tell this court, excuse me, that routinely as part of my job, I do check those jury instructions, and I thought I did check the jury instructions here, but you know, the pattern instruction incorporates this court's decision in Ferrier. That part of the instruction was not given to the jury. So essentially what the jury was could have done is what the state is suggesting that you should do now, which is overrule Ferrier and this body of law.
But
and
you didn't make that argument.
I didn't, but in terms of what the jury could find, that instruction sort of maps out a strict liability offense because they weren't instruction on that Ferrier provision. So when you're asking what could the jury have done, the jury could only do what they were instructed to do within the confines of the elements of the offense. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. I just want to touch briefly on the interaction that the court has had with appellant's counsel this morning, and the idea that we should compare the discussion that the officers had with this defendant and compare it to the conversation that we're having today. I just don't think that's a fair comparison. I think I'm safe in saying that none of us in this room would meet the probable cause standard for being impaired by either drugs or alcohol. But that's the nature of the beast anytime we're dealing with these cases. We've probably all seen lots of videos of implied consent readings where defendants have passed out at the table, or they're just non-responsive, or they won't track what the police officer is asking.
But there's something in between, isn't there?
Sort Certainly.
In between the non-responsive, incoherent, and then the clear responses to providing answers that seem to correspond to questions. I mean, there can be this middle ground, can't there, where we can perceive because of sleep, because the defendant is sleepy, or other circumstances, is having a difficult time responding, and we may not necessarily track or treat the transcript as a linear conversation, question, answer, direct response.
That's correct. But If the defendant fails, getting back to the implied consent, do you wish to speak with an attorney? If the defendant or the suspect doesn't say yes, at some point in time, the police officer is going to pull the plug on them. Similarly here, if you don't say yes, that I'm going to take the test, and you never provide the test, that will be treated as a refusal.
Under a circumstantial evidence analysis.
Well, that's fairer.
If there's, yes, if you don't respond at all and you fail to go along, yes. But that's not what we have here. We have a response, and counsel's asking you to go beyond what that response is and try and divine what he really meant with his response. And I'm just saying that we need to take into account that these aren't a straightforward conversation that we're having this morning.
Counsel, does it matter that, again, he was in a cell sleeping, it's late at night, and particularly part of the discussion that I'm wondering is the officer, Zaluki, goes through asking discussion about having a warrant. He then asks whether or not he wants to take something. And then the other officer says Josh, which perhaps indicates that Mr. Defoe is not being responsive. Mr. Defoe says what? The officer says he asked you a question and he says no. Does that context matter? Again, it seems to me that counsel is arguing that, you know, looking at it linearly, you asked a question, he said yes. You asked the second question, he said no. Here, particularly because there's that pause and there's the officer yelling his name, does that matter in this situation? And if not, why not?
Well, I think it's just part of the entire context here that the officers are aware of. Mr. Defoe had been defiant, as I point out in the brief. He had been uncooperative over the course of the entire day. I don't think the officers have to look at this in the vacuum of just what's happening right here and now. They're informed by everything they've dealt with.
Counsel, to that point then, that Mr. Defoe has been defiant, is that an alternative to him refusing to take the test? Rather, it's just him being defiant. Is that a reasonable alternative? And then looking at this in a circumstantial evidence context, is that one other way we could look at this, that it wasn't him refusing, rather it was just Mr. Defoe continuing his defiance?
I would look at defiance in that context as the motivation. That's the reason why he's saying no, is because I'm not going to cooperate.
But again, doesn't that go to the point, if he's saying no, not to refuse to take the test, but no, I'm just not cooperating with you in general, is that a sufficient alternative to him refusing the test?
At least enough to get us to a circumstantial evidence analysis.
I don't believe so. You don't have a right to refuse a warrant. So him being defiant, I'm not going to cooperate with that warrant, that's not grounds for refusing to comply with the warrant.
What about just I'm not going to interact with you?
If he says
that's different.
If he says I'm not going.
If the no is basically just leave me alone, that's not a direct. That may be a non-direct answer to the will you take a test.
Well, that's the problem with looking at somebody who's, we believe there's probable cause to believe that this person's faculties are impaired. Are we looking at
my question that? Isn't so much guilt or innocence. My question is focused on whether this is enough to get us to the circumstantial evidence analysis rather than the direct evidence analysis.
No, I don't believe it's enough to get us to that to the circumstantial evidence analysis. I think the police officers are entitled to take the answer as it's provided to them and not delve into it.
Well,
is this what you really
officers.
Mean?
I mean, the question is whether he's guilty of refusal. So it's not whether the officers perceive him as refusing. It's whether the evidence, if we're assuming a circumstantial evidence analysis, the evidence supports only the conclusion that he was refusing to give a test by his response?
Well, I guess I'm responding with the idea of what a decision made by this court would tell police officers going forward. If they hear a no, are they supposed to ask follow-up questions then to determine, is this really what you meant?
If the circumstances, as it's being argued, I'm not saying we agree or disagree with it, but as it's being argued, the circumstances are create a possible different meaning to his answer no, which might then require, for the sake of establishing a record for conviction, further exploration. Mr. Defoe, when you say no, just to be clear, you mean no, you're not going to take the test. Is that what you're saying? I mean, that's not so hard. Not too much an onerous task to put on law enforcement officers if there's ambiguity.
I'm not going to say that there's categorically never a situation where a police officer would not be obligated or it would be better practice for them to follow up on it. But that's not the case we have here.
Counsel, as a baseline matter, is this conversation from the state's perspective circumstantial or direct evidence? What analysis does the state believe this court should engage in?
I argued in my brief that this was direct, evidence of his refusal, and that the court need go no further. But if the court did want to go to the circumstantial evidence, that we still prevail on that. But my initial argument is that this is direct evidence. And I just want to touch briefly, I may have asked the court to bite off more than it can chew, and I'm asking to hold that Ferrier has been overruled. What I would suggest, or just say, that Ferrier did not add an element to the that the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt to the test refusal, crime of test refusal, and preferably do that in a precedential opinion. If there are no other questions, I'll cede the rest of my time.
There do not appear to be any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, do you have rebuttal?
Before this court asks me any questions, may I please just get a few things out? One, counsel said something about...
You get your name out first?
Oh, Suzanne Senegal Hill. My apologies.
Now go for it.
Counsel said something about this court having to divinely discern what Mr. Defoe's intention was, but that's exactly what circumstantial evidence is. You decide intent based on, you know, what the circumstances are. The state also says that Mr. Defoe was obstinate and defiant from start to finish. That's simply not true. You look at Exhibit 12 as a prime example. He's waiting patiently to be put in the squad car. When he's in the squad car, he's in there for a long time before they start to drive to the jail. He is a little frustrated at the beginning, but the majority of that drive, he's calm and collected.
I thought the state's argument there actually helped your case.
He's
defiant generally.
Sure. I mean, I sat there and it kind of does go both ways. But I just want to, you know, it's important to point out that the last officer who had interaction with Mr. Defoe before he fell asleep was the booking officer who told everyone else, I don't think he's under the influence of everything. And Mr. Defoe took a PBT. There was no indication in the record that he was defiant about that. He was asked to take it, and he took it. That sort of goes to, did he understand what was going on after he was asleep for 3 hours and in a dark cell, and they're rousing him up and trying to get him to, you know, decide whether he's going to take a blood or a urine test? In terms of, can you apply circumstantial evidence? I would ask this court to look at Sarah, not for the outcome, but for the idea that even when you have this question-answer situation, you still apply circumstantial evidence. Lastly, the state says that it argued that this is direct evidence. I don't read the state's brief that way. I read the state's brief as this is strict liability and we win, or based on circumstantial evidence, we win. I don't see an argument of direct evidence, apply Ferrier, we win. I understand the state's making that argument right now, but I don't see it in the brief. So thank you for indulging me with that, and now I'm happy to entertain any questions you might have.
So you raced through it, and we didn't even have any questions for you.
No, but I will use my time because I do think this is important. I think it's important to have that real life context. I think it's important that officers know that you can't just go in and get a magic word and then sort of celebrate on the way out and high five boys, as you know, that's kind of what it sounds like here. And also, you have a new, overzealous officer who made a lot of mistakes. And I don't think that those just come with being a new officer. I mean, these are really simple things.
What is overzealous? What would be evidence of that?
Yeah, I just, reading the record, and listening to the very end of that audio, you know, where it's like, thanks, boys. It just sort of smacks of trying to achieve something for the first time, and it was at Mr. Defoe's expense, unfortunately.
The focus, of course, isn't really here on the officer's conduct. It's the fact finder, the evidence that's presented, right?
That is true, but I think in terms of listening to that audio again, you know, the real-life application of it does matter. And the real-life application is they rushed in at 1 in the morning to try and get him to either agree to test or refuse. He's sleeping. They hear a no, and they walk out thinking that they've got it. I don't think that's what the law should require, especially when you're talking about a felony conviction where somebody's liberty is being taken away for such a long time. I'm not asking this court to do anything outrageous. I'm not asking you to overrule anything. I'm just asking you to apply the circumstantial evidence standard. I'm asking you to listen to that audio tape. I'm asking you to listen to it with real-life application.
What, if anything, should the officer have done differently after hearing the no response?
Sure. I think you hit it, Your Honor, hit it on the head with opposing counsel that it didn't take much. Didn't take much to clarify. And honestly, I've been doing this job for 22 and a half years. I've never seen anything quite like this. There's always a push by the officers because the onus is on them. They either need to get the person to test or get the person to refuse. And so there is, I mean, Sarah's a good example of that again, where there's a lot of push and a lot of clarification. I'm not saying that there's a bright line there that you have to do that. But it has to be something more than this, where it's a groggy answer to we're not exactly sure what, and then they walk out thinking they have a refusal. And for those reasons, I ask you to reverse Mr. Defoe's conviction. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ms. Senegal-Hall and, or Hill and Mr. Magnuson. Thank you for bearing with us as we violated the Judge Hallbrook's kinder, gentler, let her at least get a sentence out. But we were interested in the case, and I hope you realize that we certainly have reviewed all of your briefing, and we're just ready to jump right into it. And you did a perfect job, of course. Well, we appreciate your argument on both sides and the briefing in this matter. It's under advisement now. It's submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. So have a great day. And this being our last case on our calendar, we're in recess. Thank you.
All rise.